listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. He was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his talents, his genius, and his great endless scientific ability, has proven the luminous reality adopted by the Shia, that an imam must be the most aware and virtuous one of the people of his time. And it has also proven that the one who has more knowledge than anyone else must be the imam, regardless of whether he is young or old. Allah the Almighty has provided the infallible imams of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, with knowledge, wisdom, and sound judgment, similar to how Allah provided the prophets of the past with these same concepts and qualities. Truly, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam has shown this reality to all of the world.
Parts of Ziyarat texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back to your listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. We find that at the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the Islamic world was being infiltrated by new philosophical and theological thoughts. Not only was philosophy and theology becoming widespread amongst the Muslims, and then the Muslims themselves were coming up with new ideas and new opinions based upon this philosophical and theological infiltration. But we also see that on the other hand, the Imams very fervently and with a lot of ardor and zest, they pushed forth and explained the concepts of nubuwa, prophethood, and imamat, the leadership, and of course, tawhid, the Islamic monotheism. What we have of pure Muhammadan Islam today is based upon the teachings of these Ahlul Bayt, including the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so in one such instance where a person asked a question about Tawheed, about Islamic monotheism, about Allah and the oneness of Allah, we find that Hussein bin Sa'id had asked Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, is it possible to say that Allah is a being, a thing? In the Arabic, the word that was used was shay. Now shay can be a thing, it can be a being, it can be a it. And so in response, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says, yes, you can call Allah a being, a shay, when excluding Allah from two limits. And so, of course, Al-Husayn bin Sa'id asked, what are these two limits? And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said, the first limit that you must exclude Allah from is the limit of ta'til, or stripping Allah of his attributes, meaning Allah with no attributes. That is one thing that we cannot limit Allah to. And the second limit which we must include Allah from is the limit of tashbih, or similitude, or comparison, or making Allah similar to something else. And so here we get these two very powerful limits that must be excluded from Allah. One of them, of course, being this limit of stripping Allah away from his attributes, for the attributes of Allah and Allah are one. They are inseparable, even though the word separable cannot be used for Allah. And the second limit is the limit of tashbih. Comparison, similitude. We cannot compare Allah to anything. We cannot compare Allah to a creature, or we cannot compare Allah to something that is in our imagination. For Allah can only be said to be Allah. And if we are to truly understand Allah, then the only way to do so is via the Qur'an and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let's go to the hadith of the imam, where imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. Khafzul jinah zinatul ilm. Humbleness is beauty of knowledge. Knowledge is one of the most precious gifts of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But there is only a danger with it, and that is arrogance. And this is where Imam is saying, Khafzul jinah. The literal meaning of these words, Khafzul jinah, means to lower your wings. It's a symbol for humility. That when a person has knowledge, you know, he basically has to become humble in presence of the people. Especially if you look at the Islamic adab, Islamic, you know, manners and character in Islamic institutions of learning, this is very much emphasized. A great scholar will never ever call himself an alim. No, it's considered to be a sign of arrogance to call yourself an alim.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Liz Truss has warned of tough times ahead after she scrapped her vast tax-cutting plan and said she would carry on to try to put the economy on a stronger footing. She defied calls for her resignation. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Liz Truss is facing cabinet unrest over her plans for brutal public spending cuts across all departments after a disastrous mini-budget put major pledges at risk, including the pensions triple lock. The Prime Minister held a 90-minute cabinet meeting on Tuesday, 18th of October, in which he warned ministers that difficult decisions lay ahead. The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, told them, "Everything is on the table," as he strives to find tens of billions of pounds in savings after ditching Truss's economic plan. Health, education and welfare are among those areas expected to be hit. One Whitehall official said departments were already preparing for cuts significantly higher than previously planned, with Jeremy Hunt's tax U-turns estimated to be set to raise £32 billion, leaving a £38 billion hole in the public finances. Liz Truss remains in a precarious position, having in effect handed power to Jeremy Hunt, with a YouGov poll showing that half of the Conservative members think she should resign. A significant majority would also support a coronation of a new Prime Minister by Tory MPs. Senior ministers are expected to capitalise on Liz Truss's weakness and resist deep cuts, with the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace indicating he would be prepared to quit his job if the Prime Minister does not honour her campaign pledge to spend 3% of gross domestic product or GDP on defence by 2030. She faces a humiliating Prime Minister's questions against Keir Starmer on Wednesday, after one of the most dramatic U-turns in modern times. And No. 10 Downing Street aides are concerned rebel Tory MPs could seize the moment to publicly call for her to go. Asked whether it was no longer a question of whether Liz Truss goes, but when she goes, the former Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove said, absolutely right. Whitehall officials said planned cuts drawn up before Kwasi Kwarteng was sacked, but now paused, in which departments would make capital savings of 10% to 15% and day-to-day savings of at least 2% were now likely to be more brutal. It is fair to say that things are looking tougher than they were, one said. Every department is going to have to play a role in finding efficiencies. No department will be ring-fenced. Government sources confirmed the existing three-year spending review would not be rewritten, but said savings would be required within that because of inflation. In the next spending round from 2024 to 2025, spending is expected to fall dramatically. Jeremy Hunt told ministers they would be asked to find ways to save money, with a focus on areas that would not affect public services. He will meet each one this week to thrash out figures which will be submitted to the Office for Budget Responsibility on Friday. Late on Tuesday, The Times reported that Jeremy Hunt is poised to delay Boris Johnson's flagship social care reform and has been warned that his spending cuts may have to be tougher even than George Osborne's era of austerity. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss warned of tough times ahead after she scrapped her vast tax-cutting plan and said she would carry on to try to put the economy on a stronger footing, defying calls for her resignation. After weeks of blaming global headwinds for investors dumping the pound and government bonds, Liz Truss on Monday, 17th of October, said she was sorry for going too far too fast with her radical economic plan to snap Britain out of years of tepid growth. It was not clear whether the apology would quell a growing rebellion in her own Conservative Party, with a handful of lawmakers urging Truss to quit just 6 weeks after she became Prime Minister. Liz Truss has said she will fight on and told her top ministers she wanted to level with the public that there would be tough times ahead. A new YouGov opinion poll showed that even among Conservative Party members who backed her for Prime Minister, more than half of those polled said she should resign. A third wanted her predecessor Boris Johnson to return. Markets, which plunged after Liz Truss's 23rd of September mini-budget, are still under strain, even after her Finance Minister, Jeremy Hunt, tore up her plans on Monday. I do want to accept responsibility and say I'm sorry for the mistakes that have been made, Truss told the BBC in an interview on Monday. I wanted to act to help people with their energy bills to deal with the issue of high taxes, but we went too far too fast. Truss said she was sticking around and that she would lead the Conservatives into the next election due in about 2 years' time, although the statement was accompanied by a laugh. Earlier on Monday, Liz Truss went to the Parliament as Jeremy Hunt ripped up the plan she proposed less than a month ago, and which triggered a bond market rout so deep that the Bank of England had to act to prevent pension funds from collapsing. For some in the Conservative Party, the sight of the Prime Minister humbled in Parliament provided little confidence that she could carry on. James Hippie, a minister for the armed forces, said Liz Truss, his boss, could not afford to make any more mistakes. Truss spoke to her Brexit-supporting lawmakers on Tuesday, promising to resolve the contentious rules that govern trade with Northern Ireland, and said she was still a low-tax Conservative who would pursue such goals more slowly. One of those present said she was received warmly, in contrast to more hostile receptions from other wings of the party. Members of Parliament have been urged by government to hold off from any move to oust her before it presents its medium-term fiscal plan on 31st of October. Liz Truss was elected by Conservative Party members, not the broader electorate, on a promise to slash taxes and regulation to fire up the economy, in a policy dubbed by critics as a return to 1980s Thatcherite-style trickle-down economics. But markets reacted so dramatically that borrowing costs surged, lenders pulled mortgage offers, and pension funds fell into a tailspin.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners of Arab English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. Well, I am Asma, your humble host. This is another time that I have the honor to be your humble host. I have studied English literature, and here I am at your service. Here with me, I have two very dear guests. I hope they could introduce themselves to you.
Assalamu alaikum. I am Rita, and you know, I'm really honored with this pleasure to be here at your service. I am a medical student in Iran. Yeah.
And Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear friends. I'm Zainab Sadat, and it's quite a pleasure to be here today. Mm-hmm. I have my MA in TFL, teaching English as a foreign language, and I hope to have a really enchanting discussion today.
I don't know if it happens. I guess it must have happened to both of you, that you go to another country and then it's a non-Muslim country. They're non-Muslim people and I'm entering that community. Should I just show myself entirely? Should I just practice my religion and show them my true belief and creed? Is it the way?
You know what? I have some problem with your question, actually. Because
where of my question exactly is your...
You know what? Because, you know, a person's belief in a religion or the spiritual identity that a person has, you know, can have a direct influence in their lives, their way of living, attitudes and values and everything, you know?
Okay.
And it's not the matter of showing something.
So you mean
something.
That my
it's,
belief it, is going to affect you?
Not in that case. I mean, you will act in a way that you cannot even understand it. You know, you're not aware of your behavior.
Uh-huh. So you
but
mean that unconsciously,
unconsciously
I'm practicing my religion.
Exactly.
Which is going to consciously affect other people's
exactly.
life.
Exactly. You know, this is what I'm trying to tell you. It's not about showing. You will show it unconsciously.
I know what you mean. So do you think it is all right as a person, as a human being who has picked a special religion or a certain sort of belief to act according to their creed?
Yeah, I do agree with that.
So it's all right. Zainab, what do you say?
Well, I believe that when you have a religion, you know, religion is your life. When you accept Islam especially as your religion,
yeah,
you have to practice every single deed of Islam, thought and teachings in your life. So
I guess
you
could work for all the religions.
Yes, and in Islam, it's somehow more apparent.
Yeah.
Especially for women.
Yeah.
When you enter in a new community, a new environment, maybe, you don't have to say about your beliefs. You don't have to tell them, well, I'm a Muslim, I would do such and such and such. No, you could do just whatever God has asked you to do.
It's not just like that. I'm entering a room and they are non-Muslim, and I would say, okay, see, I'm a Muslim woman and I'm wearing hijab. So it's not going to act like that. I am going to enter a community, and just as we test it, unconsciously, I am practicing my religion. Through the way I'm talking to other people, through the way I have interact with other men, and through my appearance. It's already
That's
clear.
What you're supposed to do, you know, ask more.
So do you think it's a right for me to practice my religion in a non-Muslim community?
Definitely. When you are a Muslim, you are supposed to be a Muslim wherever in the world.
Yeah,
so that does
true.
Not make a difference. The problem, that might be called a problem. The thing is that sometimes people would ask you, and not even asking you before that. Sometimes you have to explain about some actions that you have to take as a Muslim. And yeah. I'm talking about
but
those
you know,
actions.
I don't see it as a problem. I think it's more, you know, just amazing that they are curious about the way you are and they want to know more.
Yes,
exactly.
They are. But you know, Vita, there is a big propaganda at work.
Yes,
which says to
that.
Many non-Muslim people, it would be like this, that Islamic countries or Islamic communities or just Muslim people mm-hmm. have got some certain thinking, some certain sort of attitudes that is not very much pleasant.
I know.
It could be sometimes true that you enter a non-Muslim community and they are normal human beings. And when they see that, for example, you go to the same restaurant, yet you pick halal foods and they pick the other foods. So you have restrictions for the kind of food you eat. They would be curious for that and they would ask you. And since you are just human beings, friends, you are having a chit-chat, it would be something interesting for the other people mm-hmm. to know about some certain things that belong to religion. But the problem, just as Zainab said, is for when they have an impression about Islamic countries or Muslim people.
You know, actually the thing is, the majority of all of the people around the world have a good viewpoint, you know, about your religion, no matter what religion you have. But as you know, there are some people around the world that, you know, they have some racist mindset or something like that.
Yeah.
And they act like you're a stranger. They act like you're something that is different, seriously different, and you feel like, okay, is this exactly my problem that I'm different?
Yeah.
And this thought will somehow be annoying in another country when you're going to go for a study or something. It will bother you.
Exactly.
You know what I'm
You know, I'm just going to tell you that since we talked about propaganda and media and mm-hmm. since it is at work and it's working pretty much strongly and in these matters, it would come pretty much naturally for other people not to know about our religion and they would feel like some sort of insecurities towards us. When they come to our country, when they come to Iran and they see the women and how they're doing different sort of activities in the world, they're so much shocked. I've seen of those people.
Exactly.
And this is unfortunately the effect of media, I think.
Exactly.
The bad images that they show to the world about our religion, mm-hmm. about our way of living in this country, unfortunately.
Exactly. They think we're dull creatures. We do not have any fun in our life.
The women are oppressed.
Yes.
You know, once I went to the Holy Shrine and then some people from Norway, I guess, we had a visit and they were so surprised by seeing women in that way, just the way you said. And they told me that we feel a certain type of peace in this place and everything seems to be in its right place.
And they have some sort of impression about us, mm-hmm. Which turns out to be the other way when they meet us from the very country they come to visit. From the very moment they meet us, they understand from the airport to start.
Yes.
They would have a different connotation about us.
Yes. And if you ask them, most of them would say that they would love to travel to Iran.
Yeah, exactly.
For several times.
Yes. We are are talking about being Muslim and showing your religion to other people. And by showing, I actually mean that unconsciously you start to practice your religion in different situations. Now, you live in a Muslim country, it's going to be no problem for you. It's going to be so easy and you're not going to understand anything different from the life of other people. But when you come to travel into a non-Muslim country, just imagine that you're going to go into another country for studying. And in that country, the majority of people even do not know about Islam. Mm-hmm. Not only they do not know anything, but also, according to propaganda, they're going to have some bad
background.
Images. Yeah, okay. It's going to work like an impression. So I am a student and I'm entering a class and most of the people are looking at me as an alien.
You know what? I think this difference will make a wall, and this is something natural, you know, no matter which religion you're from. It's like when you are different, you have a kind of even different appearance in a society. It's like, okay, you are different and there is a wall around you, surrounding you. And for breaking this wall, you have a mission. There is a necessity to show yourself.
Yeah.
And to elaborate it.
To prove
humans.
Yourself.
There are humans, then they will understand you if you speak logically, I think.
Mm-hmm. We have different colors. We have different rituals, different languages. Because we live in different continents, in different countries.
But at last, we are all humans.
Yeah, that's the point. That's the core of what we are talking about, is that we are human beings. As just we're talking about every person's right to practice whatever they have as religion in front of others, I would ask you, is it going to be easy for you to live in a non-Muslim community and then be the way you are? You're going to remain untouched. I mean, as in not changing yourself. I'm saying that I'm talking actually about the difficulties you're going to face as a person who's Muslim, and now he or she are entering a new zone, a different zone.
Which is not Muslim.
Yeah, which is not Muslim.
Yes, you know, that would be quite a difficult task.
It takes time for you to get accustomed.
You know, it's a really shocking situation for every person. And I know lots of people who entered such communities and they were so shocked that for a while they could not go even out of their home.
Yeah.
You know, they could not communicate with other people. Whoever they saw, they thought that I cannot communicate with this person. They might
they don't even go out for buying things, you know, because they think that people are giving them with their eyes, they're just showing them that you're a stranger. What matters in here is just, as you said, humanity. And I guess us as human beings have to respect each other's belief and creed, no matter what it is. But I know that some thoughts are not respectable, but I guess that as human beings, we have this right toward each other to respect each other.
Yes.
Whenever you go into a strange society, whenever you enter a new community that is totally different with you, you have this feeling that, okay, I'm the stranger.
You know what? I want to tell you something. When you go to another country, you feel like I'm the stranger or something.
Yeah.
I'm different, or, you know, all of these thoughts will make you busy. And you just don't think about the point that they feel the same.
Yeah.
You know what? That there is a feeling exactly about them that, okay, I am a stranger too for this person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am different. I have my different thoughts or something like that. But I think we are all humans. And at last, we have to try just not to make atmosphere which there is discrimination in it.
We'll be back in a very short time. So let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you for listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
we had this discussion about judging other people, mm-hmm. which I guess it would come in handy about this topic as well, because most of the problems that are created come from judging other people and other religions. So we should respect each other in that sense as well.
You know, when it comes to Islam, when it comes to the Holy Prophet, when it comes to a Muslim society, when a non-Muslim person or a Muslim person from another society enters that society,
that new community.
Yes, you know, it's again quite interesting for me. For example, Salman al-Farsi.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's right.
You know, he came from a non-Muslim country. I guess Iran had not accepted Islam yet. So when he entered into the society, the Muslim society, the Holy Prophet...
He was welcomed by the Holy Prophet.
Yes,
yes,
he welcomed him as warm as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and that shows...
To the point that the Prophet said that Salman al-Farsi is one of us.
Yes, he's mm-hmm. one of us. It's really humanity.
The core of humanity.
You know, if this happened in another country, throughout the whole world, you know, the problem would be solved.
Yeah,
you can see that.
All the people all around the world practiced humanity.
The real Islam is pure, and you know it will touch everybody's soul.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, if there was only the truth that was spreading mm-hmm. all over the world, and there was no propaganda, and there was no media against us, then everything would have been solved, and there would be no hostility toward Muslim people. We were talking about Muslim creatures who enter a new community, which is odd and strange for both people, the one who enters that society and the one who is accepting that stranger or the newcomer. But the thing that matters is that humanity is all the same in all the religions, and we must respect each other's religion, each other's color, and whatever that is different from us is not going to be a sign of alien. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabb. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned.
اگه بنده من نبودی بنده هر کس و ناکسی باید باشی.
Allah states that if people do not be his servant, then they have to be the servant of others. As we read in Ayah 39 of Surah Yusuf, are different masters better or Allah the one, the all paramount? It is very much better to serve Allah rather than the creatures of Allah. Now, freedom is the fruit of servitude to Allah. You serve Allah and then become free from all the belongings and other types of servitudes. Therefore, all the prophets of Allah were sent to state that the only way to be free is servitude to Allah. The only path to freedom is servitude to Allah. In this way, we can be free from all the belongings of this world. Then we feel more comfortable in our life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the Cyber Division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless. The US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran is part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflicts. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
Beijing's Great Hall of the People saw Xi Jinping, the Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, attempt to cement his power by setting out to clinch an unprecedented third five-year term as president. In his address to some 2,300 officials and delegates from across the country, he laid out his policies and lauded some of his government's achievements. Among those achievements, President Xi reiterated the validity of his harsh zero-COVID policies. Policies which, to this day, shut down major cities and operations in China sporadically and disrupt businesses in a world increasingly accepting of COVID-19 as a reality to live with. In fact, China's civil aviation predicts that by the end of next year, the country's air traffic, while double the current figures, will still be just 15% of what it used to be before COVID. The policy's toll on people's mental health, though, may have been the biggest cost of China's success in containing the virus. Repeated lockdowns has resulted in the Chinese youth developing gaming addictions, sleep abnormalities, and a reluctance to go outside. Of course, COVID wasn't the only thing President Xi discussed in his address. He called for accelerating the country's military development while China already spends the second largest military budget in the world after the US. The military plan aims to improve China's ballistic missile capabilities, develop various aircraft carriers, and establish overseas outposts. Xi can lay out such military development plans because he doesn't just hold the title of President of People's Republic of China or the title of Secretary General of the CCP. He is also chairman of the Central Military Commission. Taiwan's relations with China as well as the US have been clearly defined in the One China policy. It is the diplomatic acknowledgement by the US that there is only one Chinese government and that the US can have no formal ties with the island of Taiwan, but rather with the Chinese government. The policy has a long history dating as far back as 1949 after the end of the Chinese Civil War, but it was in 1979 when, under Jimmy Carter's presidency, the US finally established formal diplomatic ties with Beijing and thus severed ties with Taiwan and closed its embassy in Taipei. But in that very same year, the US also passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which meant that it would support the island's ability to defend itself by supplying it with arms. The US has always maintained strong informal ties with Taiwan. The One China policy was undermined much further during Trump's presidency, and not just because of former president's inflammatory remarks about China.
And then we had the horrible plague come in from China. Boy, oh boy, what they cost the world.
It was because after decades, Tsai Ing-wen, president of Taiwan, spoke to a U.S. president, breaking diplomatic protocol. Sino-U.S. relations have only gone downhill from there. The biggest offense in the eyes of China happened when U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island in August in a move that infuriated China. Since then, Beijing's resolve to reunify with Taiwan has only gotten stronger. Xi Jinping has time and again rejected any form of separatism, as well as interference in the island's affairs, as it considers Taiwan a part of its territory. Xi's call for accelerated military development could hint at his impatience over US meddling and his increasing resolve over following through with his reunification plans with Taiwan.
We gather at a vital time for the United Kingdom. These are stormy days.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss may not have known what she walked into when she took over the premiership just months ago from the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. An economy battered by COVID-19, then the Ukraine conflict, which impacted the UK's economy negatively. With runaway inflation and a cost of living crisis, she had to come up with a plan. That plan was presented by the finance minister, or exchequer at the time, Kwasi Kwarteng. But she could never have anticipated the firestorm and crisis that erupted afterwards. After several U-turns of whether or not she would go through with what was called a mini-budget plan, she was forced to finally make amendments to the plan. And what many have called a move to save herself and her job, she fired the now former finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng.
I met the former chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him.
She replaced him with Jeremy Hunt, a former health secretary and foreign secretary, who was announced as Kwarteng's successor.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we were asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Truss scrapped the pledge to reverse predecessor Boris Johnson's hike of corporation tax from 19% to 25%, a decision estimated to restore around £18 billion, or $20.1 billion to the UK Treasury's coffers by 2026. Her explanation for scrapping the plan, markets were not ready for it.
But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies had doubts on this so-called mini-budget, basically calling into question where the money was going to come from. It said that unfunded tax cuts meant that the UK will need £60 billion in spending cuts. It also said that this would leave ministers making serious reductions in public services. This puts into question the claims made by the former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue.
As for the 2.5% targeted growth, nonsense. Said the UK will struggle to grow at more than 0.8% on average over the next 5 years. In other words, the £45 billion cost of the mini-budget would wipe out any financial space left to the Chancellor by his predecessor, swelling Britain's debt as the share of national income for at least the next 5 years. The turmoil that exists in the UK mirrors what is happening across many European countries. Economies are under strain and people are suffering as a result. Wrong fiscal policies can be the reason for this suffering, but political directives also impact people's lives and well-being. That couldn't be more evident on the EU, led by the US, to continue the war on Russia, even if it meant that their own citizens would suffer as a result. But cracks are emerging following the US lead. For example, France has joined Germany in accusing the US of using the Ukraine war to overcharge for gas. After the Ukraine conflict, the EU was forced to start importing LNG from the US, as well as other countries. But the US's share had increased sharply, from 28 to 45%. On the other hand, deliveries from Russia dropped by 75%. But this statement from the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, shows that France may have caught on to the US role in the Ukraine conflict. Le Maire recently told French MPs that the conflict in Ukraine must not result in the US economic domination and a weakened Europe. This is while the economy minister, Robert Habeck from Germany, accused LNG exporters, including the US, of charging too much for gas at the time when Europe's biggest economy is struggling to balance its energy mix without Russian supplies, and when German companies are closing down factories due to high gas costs. Electricity cuts in the UK and emergency gas rationing in Germany are just a couple of signs of how European leaders are sacrificing their country in order to defeat Russia and the less threat that they face from it. As for their economies, Europe has already slipped into a recession, and there are no signs that it can devise a plan that would lower energy costs to pre-Ukraine conflict levels in order to save their economies.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978 which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then US President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering US Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve